Welcome to the Prescription for Admission podcast, where we talk about hospitals and hospital-based care, who you can expect to meet, and what you may experience during your time in the hospital, both as a patient and also as a healthcare provider working in a hospital. My name is Dr. Monique Nugent. I am a practicing hospitalist and also the author of Prescription for Admission, the book, where I talk about many of the same topics. Thank you for joining me and enjoy the show. Hi, and welcome back to the Prescription for Admission podcast. I am your host, Dr. Monique Nugent, and this is a podcast where we talk about all things hospital. And today I am joined by Dr. Tola Johnson. Dr. Johnson is a board-certified emergency medicine physician practicing after residency over 10 years in Southern California, a place I love and lived for a long time and thoroughly missed. And now she's in San Diego, an even better place than I was in residency. So I'm thoroughly jealous. And she's married to another emergency medicine physician. They have two kids, an 8-year-old daughter and a 7-year-old son. So she has carved time out of her day to be here with us today to talk a bit about the experience of the emergency department. Dr. Johnson, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. And I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah. So this is an exciting topic because everybody knows the emergency department in a hospital or the emergency room. And I actually, when I talk to people, I say it's not a room, it's a department. They do so many other things, you know, it's a huge specialty. But it's kind of a cornerstone of people's hospital experience. Absolutely. Whether they come and go, whether they come and stay, the emergency department and our colleagues in emergency medicine are really the front line of hospitals and the first people meet when they go to a hospital. So thank you for spending some time to talk about this, because this is a huge, huge topic.
Absolutely. Happy to be here. I mean, I feel like for a lot of patients, the ER, the ED is the only part of the hospital they ever actually see. For probably a good 50% or so of the patients who come in through the emergency department, because we don't admit most people. So understanding the role of the ED, what we do there, what we don't do there, our role with the rest of the hospital and the hospitalists and admission is, I think it can be really key.
Yeah. So how does one become an emergency medicine physician? What is the career path to emergency medicine?
You know, it can take a couple of different pathways. I'll describe mine. I knew from a pretty young age that I was interested in going into healthcare and medicine. I had a lot of family members who were doctors, kind of kept me away from medicine. But, you know, by the time I got to college, I was pretty sure about my path. So in college, I did consider law, journalism, a few other things, but I ended on the pre-med pathway, subsequently went to med school. And then in med school, when you really decide upon your specialty, you are exposed to all the specialties, most of the specialties, I should say. The first 2 years are more didactic. Second 2 years are more experiential. You're actually out doing rotations. And that's when the fun really starts. In meeting people working in emergency medicine throughout med school, even before that, had some friends and neighbors who were ER doctors, I kind of knew that those were my people. You know, there is a culture to every specialty, and that can be regional, that can change. But I think it is not just in America, I think internationally, there's kind of a culture to the people who want to work in the emergency department, a certain personality, one might say. And I kind of clicked with the ER people more than other specialties. I did consider anesthesia. I did consider orthopedic surgery as well. But in doing the rotations, I think what spoke to me about EM, emergency medicine, was at the root of it, medicine really is a profession. It's a career of service.
Yeah.
It's about healthcare. Yes, it's about wellness and trying to bring people back to wellness and using science and data and research to do all that. But the cornerstone really is empathy and sympathy, compassion, and working for others in their most vulnerable time. You know, when people feel unwell and they feel sick, it truly is the most vulnerable time. And it is such a privilege that they trust us, that they come to us in those times. And I think the ER, the ED is the place where people truly are the most vulnerable. It is often where the people are the sickest, or they're concerned that they are the sickest. They're the most scared, the most baffled about what's going on. So in that setting, in that very vulnerable space, giving care then just always kind of appealed to me. So that always appealed to me. And I kind of liked it all. I liked all the different specialties in medicine. I love that working in EM, we do see it all to some extent, depending on where you work, clearly. But I loved procedures. I loved the things with like the blood and the needles and the tubes and the amputations and the trauma. So I really enjoy that. The cardiac emergencies, the neurological emergencies. Mm. But I also really loved working with pregnant patients and kids and the run-of-the-mill, you know, less sexy, less sick patient. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be able to manage all of it. And in the ED, you do see it and manage all of it. And I really appreciated that, and that spoke to me as well. And, you know, the ER-ED, for better or worse, it is the safety net. It can be the safety net. And this is it's a full topic. You could spend a full hour just talking
about things. We'll revisit that. Yeah.
But it is a place for people who don't have resources, who don't have access to care. It's really the only place where they can see a doctor. And for people who do have access to care, given that we have really hard times with primary care, having enough primary care practitioners, they may have a doctor, but they can't see them for 4 weeks, or they're concerned about something going on right now. So it is a safety net. And that was really important and is still really important to me, maybe now more than ever, working in a setting that is a safety net for all patients, all people, no matter what their background might be.
Yeah, you touched on so many great topics in that. One thing that you said that is very true is that there is a culture to each specialty. Mm-hmm. I'm an internist, and when I worked in the emergency department as a resident or a medical student, the things that I saw my colleagues in emergency medicine like thriving off of drove me batty. Like, it was sensory overload. Like, I walked in and it was like sights and sounds and smells, and I would have to find like a little corner and be like, okay, this is where I can be, because I needed to kind of function very differently. And I think that's a great thing about medicine and people who are considering going to medicine. There's a place for you.
Totally.
There is a culture for you in each specialty. I guarantee you, you'll get that feeling, like Tola was saying, of like, these are my people. Right. I get it. Like, you find a place where you fit in. And you are right that it's not just the ER, or sorry, the emergency department that is now becoming a safety net. Hospitals are also filling that void where people can't get appointments, people can't get procedures, people socially need a lot of help. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there's one place that is always open across the United States, and that is the emergency department. It's a place where people know they can go to get help, even if they're not really sure what type of help they need. And so you're right, it's service. And thank you for being of that service for our patients.
So, of course. Wonderful. And, you know, it's such an honor and privilege to be there and to do that work. But the flip side of that is, of course, you know, when you are that safety net, you get issues with overcrowding, you get issues with resources being stretched beyond their capacity. We all know that we are deep in a mental health crisis in this country.
Correct,
yeah. We are deep in a substance abuse, opioid crisis in this country, and mental health and opioids and drug abuse often go hand in hand. And a lot of those patients, I would say the majority of the patients who fit into that, unfortunately, who are struggling with that at some point are in the ER. Yeah. Looking for help. And it can be really disheartening because there's just not enough resources. And it's hard to juggle all of that. So you're seeing that patient next to the trauma patient, next to the cardiac patient, next to the cute kid with the fever. So it is indeed sensory overload, cognitive overload. But that for me, you know, and my husband's also an ER doctor, we are the people who thrive in that setting.
Yeah.
When we come home, our house is the opposite of that. Yeah. We are like allergic to drama outside the ER, but it's such an interesting and unique place. But just like you said, the people who belong there, like, you find your people, you know who needs to be there.
Yeah. So when someone goes to the emergency department, I think we're all familiar with that really busy waiting room where you kind of see the huddled masses. And there's one or two nurses doing triage.
Yes.
And triage, I don't think people fully understand what triage is, why it's done, and how it fits into what they may find is their time in the emergency department, like how long you're there, how long it may take to see somebody, and when you may get to see somebody like me, you know, saying like, oh, you actually need a little bit more care. Can you talk to us a little bit about the triage process and experience for patients?
Yeah. And this can be super frustrating. I'm so glad you're taking this straight on. So the idea of triage, you know, not just in medicine, but anywhere, is really determining how sick potentially, if somebody needs to be taken care of immediately, do we have a little bit more time? Really, what's going on here? And it's just kind of stepping a foot into the full visit. So the triage nurse will welcome you in, you sit down, whatever the setup may be, in patient's own words, they'll express what's going on, what their concerns are, what their symptoms are. And I think people often are taken aback because they might feel a bit rushed in that process. Mm. It's not meant to be rushed, but it's meant to be kind of a quick picture of, okay, these are the symptoms that you're having. And with that quick picture, we kind of get an idea of acuity level. How quickly does this person need to be evaluated? So it's a very brief interaction with usually a nurse. The patient will talk. Now we usually check their vitals, you know, see what your blood pressure, your heart rate, your temperature, oxygen saturation are. These are all really important things to know because clearly if any of those are off, this is more time sensitive.
Right.
After the triage process, which usually just takes a few minutes, you know, if the triage nurse is very concerned about a patient, given their complaints, given their vitals, they'll often go grab a doctor or go grab their charge nurse or go work on getting that patient back immediately. That is the exception. Those are patients that we're thinking about with potentially strokes or some sort of acute cardiac issue, heart attack, et cetera, really low blood pressure, things that are very unstable. So it's really to determine stability. Most patients after triage will be then put back in the waiting room if there's not a bed for them, because often there's not. And I think people don't quite get, they're like, wait, why am I now back in the waiting room and how long will I be waiting? And so a key part of understanding the ED is, you know, having kind of realistic expectations and knowing how it works. And your question speaks so much to that. Part of the ER protocol, ED protocol, is understanding that high acuity is higher priority. So a patient who is deemed to be potentially sicker, issues that are more time sensitive, they are going to take priority. So it's not necessarily first come, first serve.
Correct.
You know, the sicker patients, the more emergent patients will be taken back, will get a bed, will get a room sooner. And those are often the patients that then end up needing to be admitted by the hospice, by the internist. But sometimes people are like, I've been sitting here for an hour or two or three, and other people are getting taken back before me, or their child is going back before my child, and that seems so unfair. Yeah. So please understand that that child, that patient has been deemed to have, you know, potentially a more time sensitive, a more emergent, a higher acuity issue. And also on the other side that people don't see, triage is when you come in through, you bring yourself in. I always remind patients that there are a lot of patients who are being brought in that you don't see. They're not coming in through the front. They're coming in through the ambulance. They are so sick that they had to come through an ambulance. Also, most ERs were also running the codes upstairs in the hospital, depending on where you work. And a lot of times those patients, whatever code they may have suffered, they end up in the ER as well. So there's multiple points of entry into the ED. So because you are triage and you go back out and wait, please don't think that we are, you know, ignoring you or forgetting about you at all. No, the triage process is to try to see, okay, who is the highest acuity, who's the sickest, and we have to take care of those patients first.
Right. So the sicker the patient is, the faster that you want to see them. And there are some things that are really time sensitive, right? So you touch on heart attacks or cardiac disease, strokes. Mm-hmm. Those are like really, really acute, very time sensitive. The intervention has to be done in a certain amount of time in a safety window. And that's why the triage nurse is looking out for that. I've had a few patients say, I always call 911 so that an ambulance takes me and I get seen first, right?
Yes.
And then I've had a few say, like, I called 911, I came here in an ambulance, and they still didn't see me first. Right? And so I had to explain that, like, that process also happens on the other end, too. So I had a teacher who would say, and when the ambulance comes, the more quiet it is, the more worried I am. Mm-hmm. If the patient is yelling and screaming,
yes,
then I know they're awake, they're breathing, they have a blood pressure. But when the ambulance comes and I can't hear the patient, that's when I get scared, right? Mm. And so emergency medicine physicians and their team are always doing that triage process, like several times a day, several times an hour in the unit or in their head, like which one of these patients is the sickest do I need to go see right away?
Absolutely. You hit it perfectly. Yeah. We're always reevaluating with each patient even. Okay. Are they very sick? Are they mildly sick? That triage process goes on. And yes, coming through an ambulance does not guarantee you an immediate
bed. It does not.
Because a lot of people do that nowadays. And it can be transportation issues. There's a lot of things that go
There's
into
There's a lot of reasons why. Yeah.
Right. Even when the ambulance...
Mobility... Yeah, absolutely. There's lots of reasons why people take ambulances, but I think it's important, as Tola was saying, that just because you come in an ambulance doesn't mean that you go to the top of the list. That triage process is still going to happen when you come to the emergency department.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's a busy place. There's a ton of people who work there. The thing that I love about the emergency department is that there's almost everything you need, right? Who's a part of your team down there in the emergency department, kind of day and night?
I think, you know, teamwork, the ED is a really unique place for a lot of reasons, but teamwork is everything. We have to work as a team because there is so much going on and there's so many different types of pathology that we're seeing, so many different types of patients that we're seeing. It's undifferentiated chaos is what I always say. So, you know, it's loud, it's bright, patients might be in the hallway, and I know that's never fun for anyone, but our team has many members who are always working towards taking the best care of patients that we can. So you'll have a physician, multiple physicians, you know, depending on where you're going, you might have one attending physician taking care of a patient, or you may have a whole team. If it's an academic or a teaching hospital, maybe a med student, a resident physician, a couple resident physicians, an attending physician, a fellow, like training physicians as well. Mid-levels are a huge part of our team at a lot of places as well. By mid-levels, I mean our physician assistants or PAs, nurse practitioners or NPs as well. They are also often providing care to patients. And then we have our nursing staff, hugely important in the ED.
Yeah.
And we have our bedside nurses, and we have our charge nurses kind of running everything, watching the flow. We have float nurses that help. And then we have techs as well. Another role that is so important to the ED. So our techs will often be doing our EKGs, doing a lot of our support procedures, like putting on a cast or a splint for somebody who broke an arm or a leg, et cetera. Helping us if we're doing a laceration, like sewing up a wound, they'll be helping with that as well. So it is a pretty robust team with multiple different members, but they each have clear roles. Mm-hmm. And one thing I'll say is, you know, when you're upstairs, when you're admitted, or in an outpatient setting, you tend not to see as many team members coming and going and coming and going. In the ED, you're definitely going to see that.
Yeah.
You're going to see the tech. You're going to see a nurse or multiple nurses. You're going to see multiple physicians because it is shift work. Yes. So if a patient stays a certain amount of time and the doctor's shift changes, the nurse shift changes, understand that you might end up switching nurses at some point. You might end up having a new physician at some point. And ideally, what I like to do, I tell my patients that if I'm leaving, if I'm going off shift soon, I'll let them know, hey, my shift is coming to an end. This is where we're at. check in with them and help them understand this next physician is coming in. They'll be taking over my care. In the perfect world, I'll actually bring that physician to the bedside to kind of make an introduction. But I'll be honest, sometimes that just can't happen. But I will always let the patient know that I am transitioning their care over to someone else. So patients will see a lot of different team members, see a lot of different people. And that is something to understand about the ED. That is part of ED care, for sure.
The social safety net is also down there. So there are social workers, there are case managers who are really great at, and you were saying you don't admit everybody, but sometimes home isn't the option for some people. They have to go to a different place, and case managers really help with that.
Yes.
And help people get their, you know, the social and medical needs together to be successful. Physical therapists. Is another one that are down there, you know, so it's like the whole hospital team has just shifted themselves to be down there. And the emergency department is great because everything that you need is there to make quick decisions. Mm-hmm. And then if you're not staying, the focus on helping you be successful to get to the next step is also there. That support is also there to get you the things that you need.
Absolutely. And yes, thank you for bringing up case management, social worker. It's huge. Hugely important what we do with all these crises that we were discussing earlier. A huge part is giving those social resources. And speaking about the physicians who are, there's those of us who work in the ED, but a lot of consultants, you know, our internists, hospitalist colleagues are a huge part of what we do. They're going to be coming down to the ED as well to evaluate a patient for admission. Consultants, you know, our surgical consultants, our trauma consultants, OB, op, you know, all these other specialty physicians that we call, that we ask to come evaluate patients. That's a huge part of what we do in the ED as well. So yes, the team is quite expansive. I think part of having realistic expectations for the ED and knowing what to expect, as we've been discussing, is kind of touching on what the role of the ED is, truly, is what the job of the ED physician specifically. Okay. And I think this can also be it can give a sense of frustration as well for patients, because it's the emergency room. Our job truly is to manage and evaluate and rule out emergencies. I keep on saying emergencies because that is the key word.
Right.
We are not necessarily meant to diagnose everything. That's really not the role of the ED. It can't be our role. Now, granted, much of the time, we do diagnose what's going on between taking a history, performing a physical, all of our evaluations, laboratory, CT, et cetera, imaging. But that's not really our job. Our job is more to stabilize, manage emergencies, or to rule out emergencies and make sure that people are either safe to go home or say, hey, you need to stay in the hospital to further manage this. And I hear a lot of patients get quite frustrated, you know, you did all this, but you're telling me nothing's going on. You're telling me I can go home. That's not it at all. Clearly, something is going on, but our job is not to diagnose everything. That can't be our job. We cannot take the place of primary care. We can't take the place of follow-up, of subspecialty follow-up. This is not to say that nothing is going on, but this is to say that we've ruled out the emergencies and that you can safely go home. And of course, within that, we're going to help you manage your pain, your symptoms, talk about supportive care, take care of your fever, help you understand who your kid needs to see next. All those things are part of ED care. But just to touch on that point, that we can't diagnose everything. We won't diagnose everything. And that's unfortunate. I wish we could, but that's just not the role of the ED.
And I think it's important to talk about the fact that diagnosis is often a journey. You know, and it's something else that, like, even on my end, where you may spend 2, 3, 4 days in the hospital with me, you may not leave with the diagnosis. There may be specialized labs that have been sent out or procedures that still need to be done, or you leave with a diagnosis and then you go see your specialist and you look at all of those things and it changes again. Right.
Yeah.
And what I tell people, because oftentimes I hear people say, like, well, you really need to make sure you don't leave that ER, or you don't leave that hospital without a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And I push back pretty gently and I say, no, I want you to consider that you don't leave without a plan. Mm. And that plan, you know, be it from the emergency department saying, my plan is to see the cardiologist, my plan is to finish these antibiotics, my plan is to go to physical therapy, my plan is to see my PCP. Right. So I can get something else, right? And it's the same kind of thought process at the end of a discharge from a hospital. Mm-hmm. I want you to have a plan. And so sometimes that plan in the emergency department is to spend some time in the hospital. Right. So how do you make that decision? What makes somebody, a patient, you would say, no, I'm going to give Monique a call. They need to come into the hospital. Because oftentimes I show up at the bedside and I say, hey, I'm Dr. Nugent here in Michigan. And they're like, I wanted to go home. What do you mean I need to stay? Yeah. And like to you and I, we're like, well, this is a good person to stay in the hospital, but people have different plans. So what goes on that would make you say, this patient needs to stay? This patient isn't safe to leave.
Yeah. I mean, there's kind of, you know, the obvious ones. If it's a life-threatening issue, if there's any kind of instability, and that could be vital signs issues, if the blood pressure is too low, if someone is confused, they're not mentating or thinking or speaking or acting the way they usually do, if there's been some sort of acute issue, you know, dysfunction in the brain, the heart, GI tract, et cetera. Those are all things that we can't necessarily fix in the ED. It's going to take a team approach, inpatient approach to get them stabilized and get the patient safe to go home. So there's that. And then there's safety from, and you touched on this, you know, some people may not have any kind of acute medical issue that requires any kind of intervention or surgery or medications, but they're just not safe to go home.
Yeah.
Someone can't take care of themselves. They can't manage what's going on with them from a medical standpoint, from a health standpoint. That person might require a stay in the hospital, and it might be more to stay in the hospital. And you have much more, you know, experience in this than I do, to then kind of segue into another type of setting, be it a nursing facility or rehab, et cetera. But those are the people that I'm thinking about giving my hospitalist colleagues a call. Mm-hmm. And then anyone who needs acute kind of subspecialty care, anyone who needs a surgery, something operated on, those are all the things that clearly I'm going to be admitting someone for. But then there's a lot of nuanced ones that may come where, you know, if someone just doesn't really feel very well and doesn't have a lot of family support at home, and maybe I think they need to be watched a little bit longer because something happened that brought them in and I can't find the diagnosis or the cause of it, but I'm concerned enough that I call my colleague and say, hey, maybe we can watch this person overnight. Make sure that they're staying stable, make sure it doesn't happen again. So I may not have kind of an overwhelming abnormality that I've identified, but the story is concerning enough that I'd like to keep them in a setting where we can observe them before I can say, okay, you are safe to go home.
Yeah. And safe is the key, right? Safety is the big, big issue. So sometimes, like actually my last shift, I had a person who the emergency department asked me to admit. And she said, well, I just came here for a bum knee. Like, I want to leave. I want to go home. I said, well, can you walk? She's like, no. I said, well, how are you going to, like, be safe in your environment? And sometimes it's about staying for a couple of days so you can, or even a day, you can work with a physical therapist. You can get the crutch. You can get the walker. Like, so you can return to your environment to be safe. Absolutely. Right? On the other end, if somebody is being discharged from the hospital or from the emergency department, they feel like, no, I really want to stay. I think I am not safe to go. How do you suggest people advocate to have, you know, the physician take another look and see if this really is something that would benefit from further care in the hospital?
Absolutely. And this happens not all the time, but with some frequency for sure. And, you know, whenever a patient says that to me, you know, after everything's done, I have my evaluation completed, I always go back and speak with the patient and discuss the plan. I'd like to admit you to the hospital, or, you know, it looks like you're safe to go home. Here's the plan. And if someone verbalizes to me or vocalizes, you know, their trepidation or they feel that they're unsafe to go home, my next question is always, why? What are you concerned about? And, you know, really in specifics, I have them kind of talk to me about what they're concerned about. I think a lot of that, which is good discussion and discussion of a plan, you know, most people then feel comfortable. They say, okay, let's do this. You know, we've referred you to such and such, or I'd like you to call your doctor tomorrow, or I've sent them a message. We've done all this testing here. We've ruled out the top 10 things that are really scary, that are really going to hurt you. I'll tell you, most patients feel quite comfortable going home. But if they don't, and, you know, advocating for oneself as a patient is so hugely important. I'm glad you brought that up. If they really feel unsafe to go home, they feel unsteady on their feet, they feel like they can't care for themselves, then I will listen to them. And then I try to determine what it is that they need. Do they really need an acute medical stay, or is it something more like short-term stay at a nursing facility, a board and care? I try to figure out what they really are. If it's more getting to the bathroom, getting meals, taking care of themselves, that may not really warrant a hospital stay, but we're going to work with the case manager on getting them resources. They may end up having to stay in the hospital if we can't get them to a safe setting, but we'll see what our options are. So I think if someone feels really unsafe going home, please continue to verbalize that, give specifics, and your physician, you know, your care team should listen to you and talk about all the resources that are available.
Yeah. Being in the hospital for so-called social reasons is a thing, right? So people need a lot of assistance. Like no one lives in a vacuum. And sometimes it does take a little bit of time to garner those resources, as you were talking about. Get somebody on Meals on Wheels. Make sure someone has a visiting nurse. Like it's not particularly a waste of time or resources. It's the way our system is set up. And so we do play within the system. And I think as a hospitalist, it took me, like a younger version of me, kind of would like bristle at those type of admissions. You know, particularly like the resident version of me who wanted like, you know, people with pathologies. I want to see all these things. And then as I've gotten older in my practice, I've really come to understand how those things are what keeps people out of the hospital. And if an extra day to have a case manager set them up for a visiting nurse and a hospital bed and a this and a that, it's an extra day with the hope that they are not here, you know, three more days, four more days, like just give them some space and time. And so I think professionally, it is a little bit of growth for people, for hospitalists to, you know, come into this space. So like, yeah, I get it. And that's what we're here for too. So, so we've talked a bit about advocating for yourself. We've talked a bit about the triage process. And we've talked about your team. I mean, the emergency department, like I said, I'm planning on revisiting this topic over and over. But what do people need to set themselves up to be successful in the emergency department? So like oftentimes people see on TV that like, the emergency department is full of like every car accident within like a 30-mile radius, right? It's like coming in, like, but the people who come, a lot of them come by themselves or brought by family, right? So they're at home and they're like, I am not feeling well enough. I'm going to make my way to the hospital. What can they do in that preparation to come to the hospital to help be successful in their emergency department experience?
You know, I think that when a patient decides they want to come into the ED, you know, that is something that has to be taken very seriously, because at this point, you know, everyone knows it's not a very comfortable place. So if someone feels unwell enough to come in, we have to take that seriously. I would say, considering some other options, you know, urgent cares are a great option. Depending on where you are, they can provide a lot of things. Definitely not for the sickest patients. If there's anything very concerning going on, please go straight to the ED. Do not stop at the urgent care. They will send you right to the ED, rightfully so. But there's a lot of things that come into the ED that could potentially be seen at an urgent care. So that's a consideration for a lower acuity issue. When one decides to come in, I think part of advocating for yourself is really having a good understanding of your own personal health history.
Very
so good. Advocacy outside of just the ED, you know, whenever you see your primary care practitioner, whichever physician you might see, understanding your medication, having your medication list is hugely important. Understanding what kind of medical conditions mm-hmm. for which you're under treatment, any interventions or surgeries that you have, really understanding why they're done, why what's going on here. Mm-hmm. Having just a good grasp on your own medical history is really, really important. It's also very empowering to people.
Yeah.
So when you come into the ED, having that kind of understanding, bringing in an up-to-date medication list is really, really helpful as well. You know, if you've reached out to any of your subspecialists, that's really helpful to know as well. I would tell the physician that. That's really, really helpful. And then come knowing that you're going to be there for a while. Please don't have an expectations. I'm going to be in and out, you know, even when, let's say, your doctor did call ahead to the ED, which a lot do, and that's really helpful. Understand that the flow is such that you likely will not get pulled back and seen, you know, immediately. Like we talked about, sicker patients are going to get seen first. So even if there was a phone call ahead of you, which is great, please understand that there's going to be a waiting process, a triage process, just a process in general. So come expecting to spend several hours. If there's anything going on, especially with kind of GI tract, abdominal issues, anything like that, please don't eat before you come in. It seems like a silly thing to say, but I can't tell you. And I understand why they do that, because they know they're going to be in the ED and then potentially admitted. Yeah. So some patients will have a full-on, like, five-course meal before they come. Please don't do that. Our goal is never to starve you. And, you know, sometimes we don't do the best job in the ED of feeding our patients while they're there, and something we have to work on. But if there's something really concerning going on, please be judicious about eating before you come in. Someone with you, a support person, can be really, really helpful. Someone who can help advocate for you, someone who can speak for you if you can't speak for yourself, someone to also just kind of keep you company can be really, really helpful, if possible. It's not always possible, but I'll tell you, as an ED doctor, much of what I do is, you know, talking to the family member, talking to a friend, you get a better picture of what's going on, for sure. Yeah, I think also staying within a hospital system when you do decide to go to the ED, if at all possible, and this isn't always possible, right? If you're very sick, please, if you're in extremis, call 911 or go to the closest ED, of course. However, I can't tell you how many patients we have who come in and say, oh, this was the closest ED. This was the closest place to come. But they've had all their care
elsewhere.
Or a different hospital system, you know, a recent surgery, some sort of intervention, a pacemaker. They were just there 2 days ago. And while I understand coming to the closest place, it is in the patient's best interest to try to stay within the same hospital or hospital system.
Yeah.
You know, they'll have your records, they'll have your specialists. It's just better care. We are in an age, thankfully, where most places, at least in the bigger cities, do have electronic medical records, which have been a game changer for medicine, absolutely. But, you know, just because we have electronic records or our hospital, we may not have them for your hospital. And getting those records can be a pain in the ED. It's really difficult. So to the best of your ability, please stay within the hospital system or hospital where you've gotten your care before. And then come with a sense of patience and just understanding that we are doing our best. We will get to everybody as quickly and as safely as we can, but understand that that there's going to be some waiting involved. Even once you get back to the ED, it is a bit of a waiting game while you're getting tests done and results done and everything like that. Yeah, just having really realistic expectations is a huge part of setting oneself up for success when you're going into the ED. And, you know, a little overnight bag, if you know you're going to be admitted, things, well, comfort things for yourself, phone chargers, things like that.
Oh, the phone charger's a big one.
Yeah. And we have them in the ED, but we never have enough.
We don't have them upstairs.
Yeah, so bring your phone charger.
Bring your phone charger. They will, yeah, they're hard to come by.
They're hard to come by, for sure, for sure. Mm-hmm. And Yeah, I think those are kind of the important key things for people to.
That's all really, really golden. We have a very common friend who introduced us, and she helped me when I was writing my book. I said, like, give me the things you want patients to know. And it was essentially your list. And one of the things she said is, I really want people to know that there is no the record, right? Like when people said, like, did you not read my record? It's in the record. And you know, and she's like, there's no record. Like, it doesn't follow you. And if you're in that system that has seen you, what I tell patients is it builds a story, because your health journey is not just this one experience with me in the hospital, with, you know, Dr. Johnson in the emergency department. It's everything that's built up. And medicine is really about relatives, right? This kidney function, is this relatively normal for you, right? Somebody might live with a creatinine of 1.3. Somebody might live with a creatinine of like 2.3. Those are two very different things, but like, is it relative for them? And that story, the health record, if you're in the same system, it builds your story. And information is safety. And having that medical record, having your medication list, it's very telling for us as physicians. We can look at it and almost tell you what you're being treated for, you know, and so it's really key. So those are really, really great takeaways, Dr. Johnson. Thank you so much. So as we're wrapping up, I always like to ask people, medicine is, you know, depicted in Hollywood and televisions either really, really well or not well at all. and so if you were to pick a TV show or a movie that does a good job of depicting, or a bad job of depicting emergency medicine, which one would you pick out?
This was a fun one for me to kind of reflect upon. And I talked to my husband about it. I would say, you know, there's a new show called Pitt.
I've seen like four episodes of it.
Yeah. A lot of people in the EM community think it's like very well done. And they did work very closely with a lot of ER docs actually here in Southern California. So I think the writing is true, but I haven't actually seen that, so I can't speak on that. I would say like old school ER back in the day.
The
OG. Yeah.
Yes.
I feel like when I watched that show, and I did revisit a couple of episodes, it shows like the nitty gritty of the ER. I think ER sometimes gets really romanticized by things like Grey's Anatomy. Great show. I love it.
Yeah.
But when one person is doing brain surgery and delivering it, you know, it's like,
But
they're like, very pretty in Grey's Anatomy.
They're all super stuff. And they're all well rested. You know?
So well rested, right? And like, what is your skincare regimen?
Yes.
I think, you know, ER was a great show, really well acted. And it did depict the ER. Granted, it's supposed to be, you know, Cook County, like a county ER.
Yeah.
It shows the mayhem. It shows the noise. It shows the unsexiness that can happen in ER. But I love about it, it shows the teamwork, the team approach. Yeah. It shows the interpersonal relationships that are so important to making taking care of a patient in the ER really work very well. It shows the difficulties of being in the ER, being an ER patient. I think, in my opinion, it does the best job of showing very nitty gritty, but it shows what, you know, what my experience is most like when I go to work. So that's my vote. I know it's been around in a long time, but I think that's the one that's the most legit. And that's what I always tell people. If you want to see what the ER is like, check out the show ER.
Yeah. I now have a very different like understanding of it, you know, watching it as a younger person. I think I was watching it for, you know, I thought George Clooney was cute and Noah Wiley was cute and like it was really fast paced. But yes, that the thing that strikes me is the camaraderie on that show. And like the intimacy that people who work in a really intense environment develop over time. And so my emergency medicine colleagues, they hold on to their team. They're very, very much invested in each other and support each other in ways that, you know, really, really beautiful. And I think that that show does a really good job in showing that in order to work in that intense environment, it, like you need to form bonds and relationships. You trust each other. You know what each other's work is. You're invested in the patient, invested in each other. And those relationships were really, really, really key.
Yeah.
It is a great show.
It was a great show.
It's just so funny to me that Noah Wiley keeps being casted as an emergency physician. It's like the strangest typecasting. You know, there's like, what's her name? Who gets typecasted as like the bubbly girl or like the one that keeps getting married, you know?
Yeah,
the 27 dresses, right? Yes. There's those rom-coms that you're like, oh, okay, this will be another Matthew McConaughey rom-com, you know? But like, but like, who falls into getting typecasted as specifically an emergency medicine physician?
Yeah, she's an ear doctor. That's pretty funny. That's a good point. Yeah.
And he does a great job. He does a great job of it.
Yeah.
So check out The Pit. Maybe we'll do like a little an episode debriefing about it because I have my opinions on it. And so I will admit that sometimes I feel like hospital medicine doesn't get like any play on television.
I agree.
Only Scrubs. Scrubs is like the only one. They were hospitalists.
Yes.
Like people don't realize that they were hospitalists. They were caring for acutely hospitalized adults. Outside of that, it's like Grey's Anatomy where they're all beautiful and making out with each other.
And they do everything.
And they do. And like House was like breaking into people's show, like houses and looking at their cat litter. You know, that's like not, none of us are doing that.
Different type of medicine.
No. Have you met an infectious disease doctor? They're all germaphobes. They're not going through cat litter. Like they're like, don't touch that. There's a parasite in there. Don't come near me. So, well, Dr. Johnson, this has been a ton of fun. Thank you so much for spending some time with me and our listeners. And you've given us some really, really great gems. And I do want people to listen. And I love what you said. Be realistic about your expectations when you come into the emergency department. It's not going to be a great, fun experience. But if you work with your team, advocate for yourself, you know, maybe expect next steps. The thing that should come out of this is a plan and some safety. Make sure that you're safe in the next place that you're going.
Absolutely. Can I give one quick public health plug? Just because this is on my mind from my last few shifts. E-bikes. Again, you could do a whole episode on this. The advent of e-bikes, e-scooters as well, but really e-bikes. It is so shocking to me. Just the sheer amount of pediatric trauma we see from e-bikes. It's not surprising, but you know, definitely motor vehicle accidents are still a higher cause of pediatric traumatic mortality and significant morbidity. But the amount of e-bike accidents I see every shift now, and that can run the gamut from your typical orthopedic wrist fracture, leg fracture, but we see a lot of significant head injuries, significant skull fractures, head bleeds, cervical spine issues. So e-bikes, please, parents, kids, everybody. It is mostly kind of teens and young adults that I see it in. Please take these seriously. I get it. They're really cool. But please wear protective gear or make sure that your kid has a protective gear. I'll say probably a lot of kids have it and then take it off at some point when they get to school. But it is, it's something that we're seeing a lot more. So please, please, please also make sure that if you're going to use an e-bike, you know how to work it. Good amount of patients come in, they turned it on.
And it goes too fast. And it flips back on them.
Yeah. So please, everybody, just be careful out there with those e-bikes.
You just gave me a great idea for an episode with like you and a pediatrician. And I just want you guys to like list all the things you won't let your kids do.
The list is getting longer and longer.
You and I have like a 8-year-old. And the list for them, it gets longer and longer. But thank you for that. Because
sweet plug. Everybody protect the gear and be careful with e-bikes.
Yes. So. Yeah. We want our kids to be safe out there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow.
Well, this has been the Prescription for Admission podcast. My guest, Dr. Tola Johnson, has been a ton of fun. She's going to come back and tell us all the things her kids can't do. And then, and we'll talk about the show, The Pit. But no, this is, in all seriousness, this has been a great episode. And just the start of a conversation about the experience of emergency medicine, healthcare providers, and the experience of patients down in the emergency department. So thank you. So again, thanks for listening to the Prescription for Admission podcast. Have a good one.